I'm Dr. Leif Tapanola from the Idaho Museum of Natural History, and I'm here with Peter Pruitt from Zoo Idaho, and this is The Nature of Idaho. Coming to you from the 1B, Bannock County that is, we're talking all about Idaho, its wild places and wild faces, the natural setting that makes Idaho an incredible place to live and be proud of. Today our guest is Darren Lundy. He's the author of The Naturalist, Theodore Roosevelt, A Lifetime of Exploration and the Triumph of the American Natural History. Peter, I'm excited to have this guest today because this book is really, really fun to read and kind of eye-opening about how collections were originally made for the dawn of the big American museums in the country.
You know, I think about Theodore Roosevelt through high school and college, et cetera. You learn a lot about him, but you really don't get a chance to see his love affair with our natural world.
Yeah, that's a fair point. I think of Teddy Roosevelt. I think of teddy bears.
Yep.
I think of the spectacles.
Yep.
Always picture him being outside somewhere.
Right.
But again, this book really kind of focuses in on Teddy Roosevelt as a naturalist and what that meant to him in as a through line for his entire life. And I think you'll be pretty fascinated if you've never heard these stories before. Before we get into that, Peter, you got some nature news, don't you?
Nature news.
Awesome.
Well, Leif, did you know RUN had significantly greater size-adjusted CSMI and BSI than C, SWIM, and CYC, and higher size, age, and YST-adjusted CSMI and BSI than SWIM and CYC?
I guarantee no one followed that. What are you doing?
Scientific literature has a love affair with acronyms.
Oh, we love acronyms. We shorten everything down to a few letters so that we can sound smart.
Right. And acronyms are kind of confusing.
Yes, they are.
Just a tad. So we've got a couple of researchers in Australia who looked over the last 70 years of scientific literature, and they examined 24 million scientific titles and 18 million abstracts. I think they had some help with computers. And they were looking at the acronym trend use. They have identified 1.1 million unique acronyms used in scientific literature. On a side note, the most popular acronym, and it was used 2.4 million times.
Is it OMG?
Close. That is coming in really fast.
Wow.
Yes. LOL is slightly ahead, but it's actually DNA.
DNA, of
deoxyribonucleic acid. They've also found a problem with the use of acronyms. Some acronyms mean multiply different
for sure.
things. Right.
Yeah, right.
So, for example, UA, which is used fairly often, could be umbilical artery, upper arm, upper airway, uric acid, urinary analysis. We really don't quite know.
And so is there confusion between acronyms and misusing the right acronym in the wrong situation?
Yes. And as they've gone through the 70-year analysis, they found that in titles, the use of acronyms have increased 3 times. Within an abstract, acronym use has been increased tenfold.
So I was always taught in writing literature that you avoid using acronyms, especially in things like the summary, the abstract of the piece, because you're making an assumption that the reader knows the acronym that you're using. And so you're better off just writing better and not using the acronym.
Correct. And then you also look at the problem that we have with communicating from the scientific end to, yes, the layperson end. And there's a lot of confusion and a lot of translation is being lost because of this rampant use of acronyms.
I think we need an acronym to close this out.
Okay. Yes, we do.
Go ahead.
And I want to remind you that Gandalf means gas and absorption line fitting algorithm.
Well, trivia time for us. That was a hard segue to trivia time.
Yes, it is.
TT. We're talking about Teddy Roosevelt today. When did Teddy Roosevelt create the Caribou National Forest? If you have not been to the Caribou National Forest, you have not been to Southeast Idaho because a lot of that forest land, Caribou National Forest, part of Caribou Targhee.
You know, Leif, this is TRTT time. Teddy Roosevelt trivia time.
Oh, sweet. You did it. The question is, when was Caribou National Forest made? By Teddy Roosevelt. We're going to get the answer to that and a whole lot more when we get back from the break.
Get continued access to local news and all the programs you enjoy through the Listen Live link at KISU.org. Or try using your web-connected Amazon or Google smart speaker with the command Play KISU.
I want to welcome Darren Lundy. He has over 30 years of experience in museum collections at the American Museum of Natural History in New York and the Smithsonian Institution in Washington, D.C. And he's the author of The Naturalist. It's a book about President Theodore Roosevelt's connection to nature, especially out west here, and the birth of natural history museums in the United States and building those ginormous collections that are held in those institutions. So first off, thank you for joining us today on The Nature of Idaho.
Thank you for having me.
Well, so we introduced Theodore Roosevelt as a person that, you know, most Americans know who he is, have maybe a mental picture of who he was and what he did. But your book, The Naturalist, really explores and focuses in on his life, his lifetime as being a naturalist. Where does this start for him as a youngster?
Yeah, it starts, I mean, like you say, most people know Teddy Roosevelt, of course, and they know that he has a love of nature and a great conservation accomplishment record. But most people don't know the extent to which he was devoted to natural history from the time he was even just 7 years old. And before I wrote the book, I didn't really know anything about this. And it got my attention when I learned how Roosevelt first developed his love of natural history. He was just 7 years old, and he's from New York, and he lived in New York City, and he was walking down Broadway, and he encountered this dead seal, which was splayed out in front of a marketplace to attract customers. And boy, did it attract Teddy. And he, up until that time, he was very literate. He was also a very sickly boy, and he had spent most of his time indoors just reading books and being fascinated with animals and stories of animal adventures. But it wasn't until he discovered that seal on Broadway that his eyes really opened up and that everything became real. And he ran his fingers through its fur and he looked at its teeth, and suddenly everything, you know, the whole world came alive to him. And that really got my attention, because it was the physical experience of coming upon this carcass, this unusual carcass in New York, that so resonated with Roosevelt and so resonated with me, that I had to take a deeper dive into Roosevelt and his entire life as a naturalist.
I'm curious, how did you come on this discovery of his discovery of a seal? Did he write about this?
He definitely wrote about it in his autobiography, and that's Roosevelt's own autobiography. He described that as the day he first became a naturalist is when he discovered that dead seal.
What kind of is amazing to me as well is, after he found the dead seal, where he took it from there. He kind of made his own natural history museum.
That's right. He was so fascinated, he ran home and he got a measuring stick, and he came back with his notebook and he took notes on it and started petitioning the shopkeeper to give him the seal. And eventually, day after day, he was successful. And he got a hold of the head, and he was able to clean it and preserve it. And it was the start of something he called the Roosevelt Museum of Natural History. And it was more than just a passing fad. This was the beginning of really a lifelong obsession for Roosevelt, starting when he was just seven.
That's fantastic. And I understand that birds became sort of the next maybe catalyst or way of satisfying his interest in nature.
Birds were certainly his first love. After he started, of course, again in New York City, he didn't have access to a whole lot of nature, but what there were birds, and his family got out enough that he just became fascinated with them. He didn't know at the time that his eyesight was so poor, and so he became especially adept at recognizing their sounds, and he could recognize any species in the eastern United States by its song.
I'm reminded that, you know, birding, for people I know, birding is a real great gateway into nature. Even, you know, as we live our urban lives, many of us, you know, birds are there. They come into our urban environment, and so it's very easy to connect with them. I imagine it was the same for him.
It was the same for him, but we also have to realize that birding was very different back then. There weren't a whole lot of field guides. In fact, there really weren't any field guides like we know today. And the way people studied birds was by collecting specimens. And again, a different time, and at a very young age, Roosevelt, you know, had a shotgun and would go out on Long Island or in upstate New York or various places where the family went. And he got very interested in shooting and collecting and making museum specimens of birds, hundreds of them. And this is something that he did on a regular basis throughout his youth, is building up this Roosevelt Museum, which early on was very heavily focused on birds.
Now, this is happening, in case folks don't know their dates so well, this is at the end of the 19th century, where are we at?
Well, he was born in 1858.
Okay. So we're in this is, 140 plus years ago?
Well, it's quite a while ago. This is before the Civil War, when he was starting his interest.
But now this is happening at a time, the context, I guess, for collections and the study of natural history was sort of at a growth phase in the United States. Could you talk about how he fits into that early story of natural history collections?
Well, when Roosevelt, it was in the very primordial days of natural history collections, where you had Audubon, you had Spencer Baird, who was the first curator of the Smithsonian. And that's the way naturalists studied nature, is by collecting specimens. But very few of them were really formed into research collections. There were some in Philadelphia. There were some early collections in New York. In fact, you know, the American Museum of Natural History was founded when he was a boy in his living room in New York by his father. So Roosevelt was very much, even as a young boy, very much present at the dawn of the creation of natural history museums as research organizations in America.
So when we look at kind of him as a naturalist, and we might be jumping ahead of the story a little bit, did he follow the typical path of a person who was collecting these samples? Did he move beyond, and we start looking at some of his work with conservation and preservation? Was that kind of the typical path that these museum specialists would be moving into, or were they just basically always collecting specimens?
I would say some of them, but it was the very, very beginnings of conservation ethic. I talk about it in the book. Roosevelt had an uncle, Robert Barnwell Roosevelt, who was a very early thinker in the conservation movement, particularly with game birds and with fish, and certainly had an influence on Roosevelt and his early thinking about conservation. But at that time, very little was known. I mean, we hadn't even described all of the birds occurring. They hadn't been completely named. You know, some of them were, it was still possible to find new species in the eastern United States. So at that time, the science was much more focused on discovering, describing species and mapping their distributions and understanding something about their migrations. And in fact, as a young man, Roosevelt, as a teenager, was engaged in very diligent studies, recording year after year when the first appearance of all of the different species of migrating birds. It just really wasn't known at that time.
I think there was also, at that time, too, the fashion industry was kind of putting a lot of pressure on our bird population. And, you know, how did, you know, did he have any effect on how people viewed birds and feathers in general within that fashion industry?
Well, I think certainly much, much later in his career, when it became much more fashionable to, certainly when he was president, he took action to protect birds and to, you know, Pelican Island is one of them. His efforts to ensure that birds weren't slaughtered for ornaments in hats. But early on, he was very, very much focused on the science of studying birds as a classical, traditional museum naturalist, gathering up specimens, you know, collecting data, and just very diligently, data point by data point, accumulating knowledge.
Now, as he is making these really scientific reports of description and discovery of birds out east, his gaze turns westward, and he starts exploring ways to get out west to I guess, the frontier, and looking in that direction. How does he start exploring the west and then eventually leading him out into the Rocky Mountains?
Well, what happened is he went to Harvard. We have to stay in the east just a little bit longer. He went to Harvard intent on becoming a professional naturalist. He wanted to become a natural scientist, but he wanted to become the kind of scientist of his dreams, someone that went out with a gun and someone that collected specimens and someone that described new species. And when he got to Harvard, he realized that the science had moved on and it was becoming less about getting in the field and more about studying things under the microscope and looking in minute detail at different tissues and things. And that didn't appeal to Roosevelt, and he abandoned natural history. And he was so adamant about wanting to do it his way or no way at all that he even dissolved his natural history collection and donated them to the American Museum and to the Smithsonian. He dispersed his collection and said he would move on and he wouldn't become a naturalist. But as I argue in the book, you can't just say you're not a naturalist. People are really born naturalists. And he couldn't escape this passion that he had. And he found a natural sort of replacement for that out west. He was just a chance encounter in a bar in New York with someone that was opening up a hunting business in North Dakota and invited him out. And Roosevelt was captivated and went out on this. He said he wanted to go west to shoot a buffalo while there's still buffalo left to shoot. And he just fell in love with the west. And more than that, big game hunting and studying big mammals became kind of a surrogate for the naturalism he had too soon given up.
So one of the big draws of coming out west is the fact that there are these big game to be had. And he's very much interested in acquiring early on a bison or a buffalo at the time. And that expands to the other sort of the megafauna of the west, all the large animals that one can hunt. This brings him to the Dakotas, it eventually brings him into Montana, Idaho. How does he reframe his sort of natural, instead of natural history collecting the way he might have started as a youth, now he's out as a hunter on expeditions and writing about it. How does that start transforming?
It's interesting because it's pretty seamless. It happens pretty quickly. He gets out west, he enjoys the hunting, he loves the action, he loves the adventure, but he's a very scholarly person. He's a very early reader, very, very bookish. And he realizes early on that hardly anything is known about these species, that a lot of people have written about them, but they've written about hunts. And no one is writing about natural history. No one is talking about what he called the secret lives of the animals. And He argued that, you know, for him, if you read his writings, his early writings on his big game hunts, they're just chock full of natural history data, all chock full of light history data. And then it has these interludes where he's describing the hunt, and he described that as the salt. He said his writing was mainly about revealing the lives of the big game, and he needed to convey that in the form of a hunting story to get interest, to get people interested in reading it. That's what people wanted to read about. But his primary focus was on the natural history. He wanted to be the nation's expert on North American big mammals.
And he went a long way in doing that for his time. It brought him out here to Idaho. I think folks in Idaho would be interested to know that he was looking to hunt mountain caribou. Maybe some of our listeners don't know what a mountain caribou even looks like.
Basically, you've got woodland caribou, and they are woodland caribou. So caribou and reindeer are the same. Reindeer are the European and Siberian type version of our caribou. So they look very similar. They're not as big as our elk, maybe a little bit bigger than our mule deer at times, but both male and female have antlers. So very cool little critter.
Well, and of course, he's writing about all of these animals and, you know, experiencing nature through giving his readers the opportunity to experience nature through authentic storytelling. And this becomes a counterpoint for other folks at that time who were writing in more of a romanticized view of what nature was all about.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, Roosevelt really wanted to, there were these writers that were anthropomorphizing is what we call it, where they give human qualities to the animals. And Roosevelt was just appalled at that. He thought, you know, he has this great quote where he says, death by cold, death by starvation, these are the normal ends of the stately and beautiful creatures in the wilderness. He didn't want to sugarcoat anything. He felt it was very important for people to understand that in reality, life was harsh for the animals out in the wilderness, in true wilderness. That was a fact. And it was just anathema to him that people would try to sugarcoat anything.
You know, I think that's great because nowadays when we have all our different animal programs and channels, that's one of the things that have always kind of bothered me is that you would watch these programs and it was always, quote, a happy ending. And, you know, that's not what nature is truly like.
Right. And it you know, it ties into Roosevelt and his hunting. And, you know, Roosevelt didn't have a problem with hunting. Part of it is he was collecting specimens for science. But another part of it is he realized that predation was something that was not only natural, but very common, and that most animals didn't live very long in the wild.
So, you know, fast forwarding a little bit here, of course, Teddy Roosevelt has a whole political life going on. In 1901, after being vice president for the now assassinated President McKinley, Teddy Roosevelt becomes president. And that puts a little bit of a damper on his ability to get out and be a naturalist, so to speak.
Yeah, it kind of spoils his chances for getting out and doing some hunting, and it really shuts down his active participation in being a collector of specimens, but I wouldn't say it closed his opportunity to be a naturalist. He became just a very different kind of naturalist. He became a politician naturalist, and we should be very grateful that he entered this phase of his career as a naturalist. He transformed himself, and as a result, 230 million acres of land are protected. I mean, that's the core of Roosevelt's conservation record. 55 wildlife refuges, 5 national parks, 150 national forests. That all happened when he was president, and that all happened because he was a naturalist. Everything that came before was leading up to that. It didn't just happen automatically.
You know, I might be mistaken, but what was his role within the Grand Canyon? Did he help with that?
Well, he certainly, you know, he had a role to play in that. You know, I don't really go into too much detail on that in my book, but yeah, I mean, he's involved with protections there.
You did mention, we could come back to this idea of the bird reserve, just to tie it back to what we were talking about earlier in terms of recognizing pressures on birds and the sale of feathers. So he creates, as president, he creates the first federal bird reserve in Florida, is that right?
Right, Pelican Island National Wildlife Refuge.
So it's really interesting to see this continuity through his life leading up to presidency, where, you know, this early history as a youth, from starting by finding the seal, you know, in the street, to then being an avid birder, a hunter, naturalist, and that permeates and it informs his philosophy on leadership and passage of laws, right? So as we see the early history of President Roosevelt in his youth, from, you know, initially finding that seal in the street to becoming an avid birder to then becoming a hunter naturalist, that all builds and informs his philosophy and approach to leadership and creating laws as a president.
That's correct. He was constantly, it's a constant transformation. It's an early hardcore naturalist, an ornithologist, that then becomes a hunter, and very quickly after that becomes a hunter naturalist that is very much about conservation and conserving species and saving land. From there, he becomes a politician and becomes a very different kind of naturalist that draws upon all of his past experiences and knowledge to really put into effect policies that he knows are going to have a lasting impact.
Now, following his presidency, he, I guess, in some ways regains some freedom that he lost while being in office, of course, and sets out on this African expedition, joint effort with the Smithsonian Institution. And without going into too much detail, because I love how it's written, it's a really great sort of climactic story that you tell. But just in sketching the outline of it, the interest was to go to Africa and do some hunter naturalism and collect some of the big game before they start disappearing there, almost hearkening back to trying to collect a buffalo before they disappear in the west of the United States.
It's totally in response to what he saw in the American West. When he first went out west, he was following the railroads, and with the railroads came a transformation of a landscape and sort of a decimation of the game species. It's just civilization moving westward. And he was doing the exact same thing in Africa. He was following the newly built railroads there through Kenya and into Uganda, and then traveling up through Sudan and down the Nile and just moving through these vast habitats that he knew were going to be transformed. He had seen it all happen before out west. And so his expedition was in many ways the culmination of his expedition with the Smithsonian was the realization of his childhood dream to become this kind of museum naturalist that went out and recorded species and documented diversity before it was transformed and lost forever.
So as we look now in present day, and we can look at Teddy Roosevelt's accomplishments as a naturalist and even as a president when we're looking at some of the conservation aspects. You know, how has he maybe affected naturalists and conservation 100 years later?
Well, I think certainly his expedition with the Smithsonian was very high profile. He was one of the most popular man in the world, some people might say. Very much followed by the news. Very, you know, it was serialized. He was writing from the field and publishing articles and Scribners as he went. And it really put this kind of museum naturalist back on the map. It really gave it a boost. There were both the American Museum of Natural History, the Smithsonian Institution, many other natural history museums really got a boost from that. I mean, just imagine, popular president of the United States retires, you know, leaves the White House, almost immediately goes off on a scientific collecting expedition with a major museum. It's a big boon for museum science and really kind of put that traditional biodiversity study back on the map. It got people back in the field looking at organisms, you know, getting out from under their microscopes and getting out of the lab and getting out and actually looking at animals and actually writing things down and understanding something about the way nature really works. That's Teddy. That's what he ushered in.
Well, that's fantastic. Really appreciate it. And the book itself is a really fun read and can't recommend it highly enough. Can you help us with the trivia question that I posed at the beginning of the show? Of course, Teddy Roosevelt, he created the Caribou National Forest, which is here in southeast Idaho. When did he do that? In what year?
I believe it's 1907.
1907. That's not too far after statehood of Idaho at the turn of the century. So it was one of the good turns that Teddy Roosevelt created for us in our land, and people are benefiting from that till this day.
And the great part is it's right next to us. And
it's
so
right there.
When we're out there, you're going, Teddy Roosevelt helped us with this. Awesome. We want to thank Darren Lundy for joining us today. His book, The Naturalist, is available in paperback and audio versions wherever fine literature is sold.
Thank you so much, Darren.
Thank you, Darren.
The Nature of Idaho is produced at KISU-FM Studios at Idaho State University in Pocatello. Technical assistance and production by Jamin Anderson and Caitlin Hart. Music is by Idaho's very own Sons of Bannock. Audio of this and all past episodes of The Nature of Idaho can be found at kisu.org. Find The Nature of Idaho weekly podcast on iTunes or Google Play Music. For more information, click on the Idaho logo at kisu.org or send email to noidkisu@isu.edu.